Welcome to the Stories of School Leadership podcast, inspirational leaders, shared experiences, creating connections. I'm Emma Lurie and thank you for joining me as I share the journey, stories and inspiration of amazing educational leaders from all around the world. In this episode, I am privileged to be joined by Joey Niho, who is joining all the way from Vietnam, and she shares her really interesting career spanning jobs all across the globe, teaching and leading, and she talks to us about what it's like being a head teacher in Vietnam at the moment. So it's really great. Let's get into it. Welcome, Joey. Thank you so much for joining me all the way from Vietnam, which is so exciting. It's really amazing to meet you. Can you just share, you know, who you are and where you are currently in the world?
Sure. So thank you, Emma, for having me. It's a pleasure. So I'm working in Hanoi at the moment, the capital of Vietnam, and I work at a bilingual school. So it's a school where students study both the Vietnamese and national curriculum. And for the international curriculum, we're running the OIC curriculum, which is Oxford International for grades 1 to 8, and then Oxford AQA, IGCSEs and A-levels from grades 9 to 12. And I've been in Hanoi for 12 years. I'm Vietnamese, and I was born in Vietnam, in the south of Vietnam. And after I finished primary school, my family moved to California. And I attended middle school, high school, and university in California. And I've moved around a bit, and then I decided, okay, I should move back to Vietnam and see what it's like to live in Vietnam. And my plan was to live in Vietnam for maybe 2 years. And it's turned into over a decade. Ah. And now I'm still here. Yeah.
Well, because it's an incredibly beautiful country. But that's only from a tourist perspective. So I don't know. But I'm hoping
it is. It's a very interesting country. It's a very young country. Like, it's developing very, very quickly. So definitely, like, I'm enjoying being here and to see the development, like, right in front of my eyes, literally.
Amazing. So, well, it sounds like you will have had a very interesting school experience then. And that's what I'd like to start with, is finding out about how people's own school experience, how that was for them, just, you know, what they experienced. And ultimately, sometimes that, or very often actually, that kind of has an impact on why, or, you know, people went into education. So tell us a bit about your two versions, I guess, of school then in Vietnam and then in California.
Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned, I went to primary school in Vietnam, and I actually don't remember much because, you know, when I moved, I think your brain just kind of works that way. Like it forced me to adapt to life in America. So it kind of, it has blocked me from remembering a lot of my memories in Vietnam. So I don't remember a lot of my primary school experience. After I finished primary, then my family moved to California, and I attended middle school in California, and it was a bit challenging, of course, because I needed to learn English, and it was a brand new country, brand new culture, but it was all in all quite positive because I had a lot of nice teachers. My homeroom teacher in grade 7, Mr. Austin, was very nice. He made me feel very cared for whenever we interacted. And I remember the school principal the most. I don't remember his name, unfortunately, but I remember that he was always around. Wherever we went, I felt like he was everywhere, like watching us. But he was really nice. He always said hello. He always had a big smile. And that made a really big impression on me. So that was middle school. And then high school wasn't very negative, but it also wasn't that interesting. Like, I just wasn't very challenged. And I had some good teachers, but sadly, I had some not very good teachers, I have to say. I had some teachers who I felt that they were just there for a paycheck. They didn't really try. And I think that is actually inspires me today, or in the last 20 years, to be a very effective and creative teacher. Because when I was sitting in some of those classes in high school, I felt like, oh, come on, like, why are you not trying? You know, like, not you, you have what, 25, 30 students here, and many of them want to learn, but some of these teachers just didn't try. I remember one actually didn't get out of his chair. I
You're like,
think,
I'll just let
no,
me
I'm
get up
not
there. I'll do
serious.
it.
Like, I think for the entire year. So, unfortunately, my experience in high school, it wasn't great. It wasn't terrible. Like, I had friends. I was happy enough as a person, as a young person, but I didn't feel challenged. And I felt that the teachers could have done more. But because of that, I think that was one of the reasons why I got into education and why I take a lot of pride in my job and why I try to motivate teachers to do a good job for the students. Because, you know, learning should be fun,
Yeah.
right? Like, there should be so much joy in learning because, you know, young children, teenagers, they have so much curiosity. And, like, it doesn't make sense to me why a teacher cannot spark that even more. So
Yeah.
that's my inspiration, is because I didn't have such an amazing experience in high school. Like, I wish that all students should and could. So that's what drives me.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, teachers, anyone at all levels in education often can relay that feeling in their own schooling. You've already said, you know, there were some teachers that really made you feel like you belonged and that they saw you, that things were fun and enjoyable, and then you have that polar opposite, and then you can feel that actually you can make such a difference if you are able to spark that. I would totally agree. I think a bit later we'll probably get into maybe some of the differences around the Vietnamese culture educationally and where I am in England. But certainly joy is something that I've been talking to kind of heads around. There's this feeling that it's neat, we need more of it, and how do we get it? And all of this pressure is squishing it out of us. But before we get into that, tell us a bit about how you got into sort of teaching. Like, what was that like? How did you get into it?
So I wasn't really sure that I would get into education. I've always enjoyed interacting with young children and with teens. So in university, I was a TA. I got a job as a TA at a primary school in 1 year and at a middle school in 1 year, just to make some extra money. And I really enjoyed being a TA in middle school. This was at a middle school in Santa Ana. And I'm not sure, Emma, if you know much about California, but Santa Ana is a place with a lot of Mexican immigrants. So a lot of the students that I tutor, they were children of Mexican immigrants. And there's this stereotype that, you know, Mexican students aren't good at math, and Asian students are very good at math. So the students that I were given to support, most of them were Mexican students, and they were failing math, basically. And for me, I wanted them to get out of that mindset, to not think that they were bad at math, but, you know, if they had the proper support, if they put in the effort, that they could improve. And, you know, that it would take, you know, it would take time and it would take hard work, but that they could do it. So I followed a group of students for 6 months, and it was very rewarding for me to see them improve. They didn't get A's, anything like that, but, you know, they would, for example, go from an E to a D or a D to a C. And
Wow.
to me, to me, that was enough. And, you know, that was enough for them to be proud of, you know, of themselves.
Yeah. I guess if they've believed for their whole school career so far that they are not good at maths,
Right, that they were just
if they
bad
can
at
get
math.
that done in 6 months, then you know it's amazing what the mindset will have restricted them from achieving.
And, you know, praising them for the effort, not just focus on the grade, you know, like the result. So that for me was very rewarding. And at that point, I still wasn't sure that I would become a teacher, but I knew that I could be happy doing it. And when I finished university, I wanted to move to Spain. In my mind, Spain, you know, was a beautiful country with a lot of history, a lot of culture. So I did some research to see how a person, like an American, could live in Spain legally and make money. And I learned that you could teach English as a foreign language. So I went to Barcelona. I got certified to teach English as a foreign language, and I worked in Spain for 2 years. And I taught different age groups, and my favorite age group again was the teens. So after 2 years, I said to myself, okay, maybe this is something that you should think about seriously because you do really enjoy it. So I finally decided to get a job teaching at a school. So I moved to Thailand, and I lived in Thailand for 5 years teaching at a high school, and I became certified. And after 5 years in Thailand, I decided to move to Vietnam, and the rest is history. And now I'm still here.
Amazing. What an exciting experience as you've had.
Been interesting for sure.
Yeah, well, I guess seeing the diff before we get onto the leadership bit, culturally, just I guess thinking about Thailand, Vietnam, America, and Spain, that's like four potentially quite different educational perspectives. Like, are there big differences between some of those countries, or
Definitely. So, for the sake of this conversation, I'll just group the four countries into two categories. So, America and Spain together as like Western countries, and then Thailand and Vietnam as the Eastern countries. So, in Thailand and in Vietnam, just culturally, teachers are very respected, right? You step into a school and you step into a classroom as a teacher, already you have the respect of the students. And I also feel that you also have the love of the students. The students in Thailand, in Vietnam, for some reason, they just kind of look up to their teachers, and they are not afraid to show you their affection. Versus teens in Spain, and especially in America, no, they do not show you love, because that makes them uncool. So that's a stark difference that I've noticed. In Thailand, in Vietnam, if they show that they're close to a teacher, then that makes them cooler. In America, for example, they don't want to show that they're interested in learning at all, right? They want to be the cool kid who doesn't care about learning, who doesn't care about what the teacher thinks. But I think deep down, I think that the majority of students really want to learn, and the majority of students want to connect with their teachers. It's just that I think in America, and only in my experience, of course, I feel that they just put up this wall because they don't want to be vulnerable. And I think in Thailand and in Vietnam, there's much less of a fear of that. Teachers in Vietnam and in Thailand, they're also not afraid to show their affection towards their students. Versus in America, you're not allowed to hug your students, even if it's primary. Like legally, you have to be very careful. If not, you could get in trouble. So I think that part of it is the culture, part of it is also the policies that we have that inform how students and teachers interact with each other.
Yes.
But for me, for me, students, children, teens, everywhere, I feel that they're all interesting. And I feel that if you put in the time to get to know them, you will find that you can connect with them, and they want to connect with you as well. Like I have found that to be true everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. It's where the gaps are put in, or there's kind of barriers that are different, or you need to approach it, I guess, in a different way. But having that wealth of experience of those different places must, be so fascinating, give you so much depth of knowledge in your role. So tell me about how you got into leadership. So you kind of stepped into teaching, like step by step by step, and then what was the next bit that meant you became a leader?
So my leap into leadership wasn't entirely voluntary.
You throw, you're chucked in.
Emma, I listened to your podcast intro, and it sounds like we share kind of some similarities when it comes to that. I think you were also chucked in and just
Absolutely.
accepted it and ran with it. It sounds very similar to my experience. So I was at a bilingual school here in Hanoi for 9 years. And after 2 years of being a teacher at that school, I was promoted to head of subject. And after being at the school for 5 years, my manager, so the vice principal of secondary at that point, decided that it was time for him to go back to his country, to Australia. So the school asked me to step up and take the vice principal position, and I declined because I knew that I didn't want to be outside of the classroom so much. I've always enjoyed being with the students the most. So I declined, and the school hired an external candidate for that position. Unfortunately, he had some very serious family issues, and he had to resign after only 2 weeks into the school year. So at that point, I kind of didn't have a choice, because I knew that it would have been very difficult for the school to find someone 2 years in, sorry, 2 weeks into the
Yeah.
school year, and the position couldn't be left vacant. So I reluctantly accepted, and I did that for 4 years. And now, looking back, I'm very grateful for that opportunity because I learned a lot for sure. I learned a lot, about myself, but working with other people. And it has also opened a lot of doors for me as well. After that position, then I went on and became a principal at a school. And then now I'm the head of school at a bilingual school here in Hanoi, Vietnam. So it turned out to be a blessing, and I'm very grateful that I had a chance to accept that position and work in that capacity. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we don't always see it like that at the time, do we?
No.
And I would wonder, well, like, I wonder what it would have been like if you didn't take that, how would you, I'm sure you'd have got into it somehow, but in it maybe a different route. So ahead, I guess, once you got into it and then you had that principal role by choice later on, what are the key challenges for you in that role, like I guess in the moment and in your last position?
I will speak about my context. So private education here in Vietnam, there are certain challenges for sure. I mean, just like anywhere, there are a lot of challenges in education, especially at the moment, I feel. But one of the biggest challenges that I have faced in that position, and then also in the following position, after the vice principalship, is it's very challenging to balance. To find a good balance between parent needs and student needs. And it's because, Vietnamese parents pay so much money to send the children to private schools. So it's understandable, right? They have certain expectations. They have very high expectations because they are spending so much money. And there's some families who they actually struggle to find that money, but they prioritize it because they believe that it will open a lot of doors for their kids in the future. And because of that, they have certain expectations. And sometimes their expectations don't match with the school's philosophy or values. And sometimes they're just not beneficial for the students. And you know that. But the challenge is, how do you communicate that effectively to the parents? So, one example I can think of right now is some parents, they want the homeroom teachers to update them on their children's progress every single day. So they want the homeroom teacher to then go talk to the subject teachers to collate all the grades, to collate comments, and then send that to them at the end of the day. And I understand where they're coming from. It's well-intentioned. But imagine the stress that causes for the child, to know that their mom or their dad is getting updates every day before they even come home. And then what happens when they come home, if it's not a good update? So it's not good for that child. It's not good for their mental health.
Not good for your staff.
No,
Where do they find what? And if they're doing that,
exactly.
what are they not
Where is
doing?
the
Because
time?
there's only so much
Exactly.
time in a day.
Instead of spending the time with the students, then they have to do extra admin tasks. And then also, what is the objective for that parent? That's something that I also would like parents to think about when they make these requests. Like, what are they going to do with those updates? You know what I mean? Because let's face it, you can't expect a student to make progress every single day like that. If a student, let's say, is not meeting standards, is failing, you need to give the student time to make improvements and to make progress. So, having updates on grades every day is not beneficial. And the challenge is, how do you communicate to the parents so that they understand that you actually want to do something that is beneficial for their child? You're not saying no because you're lazy. You're not saying no because your teachers are lazy, because most teachers aren't lazy. Most teachers are actually very caring, and they want to do things that they know are beneficial for for their students. So that's the challenge. I've sat in front of parents before trying to communicate this and say, no, we will not ask our teachers to update you every day, or we will not ask our teachers to give the students homework every day, because they shouldn't have homework every day, especially if they're in lower primary or in preschool. They're at school 7 to 8 hours a day. They should be doing something else. So that's a challenge that I found, over and over again. Pretty much every single year, I meet parents who make those requests. And a challenge for me when I speak to those parents is I have to remember to be very empathetic, because I need to remember that they are not trying to be unreasonable. They're not trying to make my life or the teacher lives miserable. That's not their goal. They just want to support their own child. But the strategies that we have that we think are effective are different, but we share the same objective, and that objective is to support the child. But yeah, so but how do we communicate to parents so that they understand that and that they trust us to let us do our jobs?
Yeah, trust is a really big one. And I, you know, it's interesting you talked about the kind of the culturally that respect is there maybe more, certainly in Vietnam than maybe in Western countries. And I would say that's a big issue, certainly here in the UK. And, lots of leaders. It's almost like a hidden element. We are educating communities and families, like as much as we're educating the children, because our core duty absolutely is keeping the children safe in school and educating them. But in order to do that well and balance those pressures of, families and community, absolutely a lot of time has to go into thinking about how are we going to communicate our vision with the families. And I mean, so much of my time as a head was spent meeting parents and managing complaints or other or worries,
Sure.
so much of that time. But it's not necessarily the thing you think of when you think, oh, if you're a head teacher, that's not the bit you necessarily think you're doing a lot of. But you're right, it's so important as well to try and put yourself in their shoes, and that could be really hard. You just want to go, my job is not to annoy you. I just go, I'm not writing this newsletter just to wind you up. Like I'm trying
Like,
my best.
I
Like I'm coming to work and trying to do a really good job here. Like, please don't tell me off. Oh, I have lots of interesting experiences of parents who just, and they're not afraid to tell you what they think. They will
Oh,
certainly here, they just,
you
say
share one?
some strong words from parents before. I'm like, please don't shout at me. I'm a good person. Oh, challenges.
I'm just curious, because I've never worked in the UK, but what are some of the hot topics for parents?
For parents, I mean, at the moment in the UK, we have a huge funding crisis in education. So lots of parents, especially if they've got maybe older children, they are seeing that shift and change in maybe what schools are actually able to offer. So extracurricular activities or, even resourcing, some of the things that we're actually able to do, events and things like that. So that finances for schools is big, and parents and families are
and that's, you know, they're not getting maybe what they had before. And in terms of the ability kind of had as many staff on site or in classrooms, ability to, you know, lots of schools I know, certainly last academic year, had to reduce their classes, so they couldn't fund the amount of classes they had, which means we've got larger classes happening. So though that the funding is really having a big knock on, and that's something that parents aren't always right, you know, rightly so, like we're not happy with it either. And then I think the other biggest thing is probably special educational needs and disabilities. So certainly in England, again, a lot because of funding issues, we have a big problem with families getting the support that they need, for children who have additional, you know, really wide-ranging needs. We're kind of, lots of areas are very full in their special educational need provision. So special schools are really full. The wait times to get support is just, I mean, you're talking 3 years for some support, which is crazy. And in turn, lots of families are struggling with behavioural issues and difficulties at home, which are having a knock on, and they're asking for more and more support from schools. And because of our funding issues and lots of other sectors, you know, you might have had lots of health professionals before, lots of those services have been cut. So we're kind of in a perfect storm of schools are the only places that can maybe offer some of that support, but they're really stretched. So yeah, I mean, certainly lots, and I think, you know, probably globally some of those are similarities, and we're seeing a big knock on, I guess, from the pandemic. Lots of communication language problems for children, lots of special education needs and disabilities. So yeah, it's an interesting time, certainly in the UK, to be in education, definitely. So I'd love to hear a bit about maybe people or things like books, podcasts, stories, I don't know, that things that have inspired you. So obviously you've had a really varied and rich educational experience and your journey into leadership as well. What are the things along the way? You've talked a little bit about the kind of people in terms of your principal and your some of your teachers, but who else or what else has inspired you along the way?
I try to find inspirations from really different things and different people. For example, I find a lot of students that just the little things that they do can be very inspiring. For example, when I get into a heated debate with a high school student and they can argue their point really well, like that makes me really happy and I get really inspired by things like that. I've worked with school leaders, who were my mentors and who helped me develop. I found a lot of inspirations for sure working with just different people from different backgrounds, like from diverse backgrounds. And I also really try to look at what teachers are doing on a daily basis and find inspirations from that and communicating that to other people, to other teachers. So for example, I worked with this amazing teacher for 2 years who every single Friday he would go through the class list of the student list of his classes and he would choose one student who has improved in something. It could be in, academic performance, it could be behavior, it could be a student who was kind to someone. And he wrote an email to that student and to the parents to say how proud he was of that student. And I thought that that was an amazing thing to do because so often when we think of communication to parents, we think of communicating issues, when something has gone wrong, then okay, then the teachers or the school will email the parents. But in this case, he was celebrating the students. And we don't do enough of that. Like, I think we need to celebrate successes more. So for me, that was extremely inspiring. And I love telling that story to a lot of different teachers because I hope that they will listen to something like that and they can see that being very small like that can impact a student and the student's family. It doesn't have to be something big. You don't have to get an A star on your IGCSE exam or A level exam. It can just be an email from a teacher on a Friday about something amazing that they've done. So I try to seek inspirations from little things, you know, daily things. But to answer your question, the biggest inspiration for me now, working in Vietnam, is I really hope to have a positive impact on young Vietnamese people, especially young Vietnamese women, because I am a bit worried about some of the negative content and values that are being spread very quickly and that is reaching a lot of people because of technology and because of social media. Don't get me wrong, I support the use of technology. I'm not against it. But we can't deny the fact that because of social media, negative content can reach a lot of young people very quickly. And that's something that I really want to do in whichever context that I'm in. You know, I want to be able to inspire young Vietnamese women, young Vietnamese female students to not just look at an influencer who has a lot of money, who is really pretty. And that's it. There's not much else. But I want them to think about, okay, what is it that they can do to contribute to their country? Because Vietnam is developing very, very fast, and there are many opportunities. And, you know, it takes someone to be motivated and to have a goal to know what is it that they want to do with their future and what would they do to reach that goal. And, you know, that's what I want to help young students, young female students in particular, develop skills so that they can be more confident, they can be more resilient, and they have self-worth that is more than just about their appearance or about how much money they can make, but what can they do to contribute to their community, and then even broader than that, to contribute to the development of their country.
Yeah, I mean, we need that globally. That's a that's yeah something that absolutely is a national and international issue, I think. And lots of schools, primary and secondary schools, certainly here in the UK, it's something they are actively exploring in their, you know, development planning. And think it's something that comes up as an issue from home. There's lots of challenges that come up because children have, or young people have interacted in a way on social media or technology, you're right. And so schools are needing to really think about those preventative measures and the skills that they're teaching our young people about recognizing what's out there and how. And for our staff, who, you know, lots of us, things are so new and so quickly. So for staff to have an understanding about what's out there and to recognize those risks, it just adds
Right.
another whole element to it, doesn't it? You know, we're talking about educating the children academically, then you talk about educating the communities, and then, you know, then you bring in social media and all that that comes with. I
Right.
mean, I know as in a senior leadership team, we've spent whole days at times trying to unpick situations that have happened that are ultimately from maybe a safeguarding challenge, but
Right. Yes.
they've usually come from social media. So
Yes.
yeah, it's a
Or
really
you're.
big issue.
Or you can engage in discussions for hours about like a phone policy, for example, you know. And to be honest, I still don't have a clear answer for myself. It's something I'm still learning about. I'm reading on this topic. I'm listening to different podcasts about this topic, because you know, for us, for my generation, I think we're the same age. We didn't grow up with smartphones. We didn't grow up with social media, you know. So we lack an understanding of what it is like for our students, right? To grow up like that, but they can't escape it. We cannot escape it. So yeah, this is a challenge for sure that we need to be able to engage with technology and social media in a positive way.
Yeah, amazing. It's been so great to chat to you. Thank you so much for your time. It's been really wonderful.
I'm really enjoying myself.
And well, the last thing I was going to talk to you about, I think you've answered it, is just, you know, your, I guess, hopes and dreams for the future. And you've talked about Vietnamese education as part of that. But yeah, is there anything else you wanted to say? You talked a bit about kind of how it's developing really fast and how it's changing.
There's something that I'm quite passionate about, and that is educating both Vietnamese teachers and parents about young people's well-being, especially, going back to social media, going back to the widespread use of technology. It is affecting their mental health, and there's a lack of awareness. I don't think in just in Vietnam, I think in many places, but definitely in Vietnam, I feel about how your mental health is just as important as your physical health and how your mind and your body are connected. And that is changing. Definitely, parents are starting to think about this more and to pay attention to this more. But there's a lack of awareness and there's a lack of resources as well for parents to learn about this topic. And Vietnam is a traditional culture. So the parent and child relationship is very much, the parent is the authority figure and the child has to listen to what the parent says. They cannot question any decisions. Usually, the older generations, they don't feel comfortable expressing their emotions, and we just don't discuss our emotions in general. Even though that's really important, especially for like a teenager, I think that that's really important to teach them how to express their emotion in a healthy way and how to manage their emotions in healthy ways. So that's something that I hope that I will get a chance to work with more and more parents on, and to, let them know that basically, they don't have to just stick to what they know. They don't have to follow what their parents did. That the world is changing, and their children are different from them. From the way that they're growing up is very different from how they grew up. So you cannot be stuck in a certain way, because if you choose to do that, you cannot communicate effectively. You cannot connect. You cannot connect with your children. So. I hope to start that conversation with a lot of different parents, and I hope to be, able to support them to actually adopt some strategies of how to talk with their kids and how to support their kids emotionally and, support their well-being and to use technology in positive ways, both for the parents and for their kids.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
Incredibly
that's my
inspiring. Incredibly inspiring. Thank you so much for your time, Jo. It's been amazing to chat to you.
Yes, it's been a pleasure. And what about you? Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so what is your view on technology with like in
Children
schools?
or in
Yeah,
schools or
in
both?
school. I'm just curious.
I think you've hit the nail on the head that we have lots of challenges created by technology, but in the same vein, there it can be incredibly helpful. The use of AI for teachers, for example, is completely changing, shifting the workload experience. So, as with lots of different things that very quickly become the norm, you see two sides of the issue. I think you're right, for children and young people's well-being, it's a huge challenge. And there's an interesting little shift in the UK. There's been a few things in the newspapers in the last few weeks around families who are making a choice to not give their children phones until they are 16 or older. It's kind of a big movement towards banning phones maybe until children are 16. So I think we're definitely much more aware of the damage that social media can do and the risks that are out there. And that's a good thing. Yes, I didn't grow up with social media at all. And I think we had a real period of time where it was very damaging and no one was talking about it. So we've moved on from that. We're now in a place where people are, but they're aware that awareness is growing. Families and schools are talking with children, educating them about the risks, the things they need to be careful of. So we are moving forward with it, but absolutely it's added a, from 20 years ago or so, it's added a whole different element to what we need to think about for our, our young people. So it's a complex issue, definitely.
It has made safeguarding a lot more complicated, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Amazing. Right. Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you, Emma, for having me. It's been great chatting to you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Stories of School Leadership podcast. We'd love to know your thoughts on this episode. Get in touch and tell us what you think, and share this episode with colleagues so we can spread the word. If you'd like some support with leadership coaching, supervision or consultancy, you can get in touch with me via the Stories of School Leadership Instagram account, or I'm Emma Lurie on LinkedIn, or you can send me an email. It's info@emmalurie.co.uk. I hope you have a great day, whatever you're up to next, and I can't wait to share the next episode with you. Goodbye.